Welcome to Mysterious Universe Plus, Season 22, Episode 18. Coming up on the show, we've got glow stick dogmen, the white hoods of the Fae, and the terror of the luck pigeon. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
Is it terror if luck is involved, though?
Terrifying. It's a terrifying fairy creature that is also a pigeon.
Well, I mean, fae folk creatures can be terrifying. We get this image of, you know, fairies being cute Tinkerbell kind of things, but a lot of the time they're treacherous, horrible little mongrel things.
Especially when they're pigeons.
Well, no one likes pigeons anyway, for the most part.
Don't we have some serious hot chaff you've already experienced on the first 10 seconds of this episode?
And I've got a lot more hot chaff ready to go.
How was your weekend?
I didn't have one. You scumbag. You set me up.
Yeah, see, George Knapp emailed at the end of the week and wanted to see if we wanted to go on Coast to Coast. And very unfortunately, I had an entire weekend of compound things going because I call my house the compound, had new plumbing going in, trucks coming over. So unfortunately, I couldn't do the show. But then I asked you, hey, do you want to do it?
And I was like, of course, it's George. Absolutely. I'll have a chat with him. It'll be fine.
Coast to Coast, you can't miss Coast to Coast. One of us has to do it. And it was funny because we got to the end of this really long day on Friday. Finally got the show out. It was like midnight. And I'm just like, the weekend. And then there's this moment where it just hits you. Like you hadn't even really contemplated what your weekend would be.
Because
George asked for all these stories, right? He asked for all this stuff for you to prep for.
Yeah,
so you had no break.
He kind of wanted to coordinate with me some of the stories that he wanted me to cover. And of course, he wanted to talk a little bit about the website. So he sends me these links and says, hey, you know, can you just be across these articles and we'll have a chat about them? I was like, oh yeah, sure, not a problem. And then I get an email from one of the producers and I find out that it's a 2-hour show. So when I hear 2-hour show, I think Mysterious Universe, 2-hour show.
Yeah.
So, of course, I didn't realize that there was obviously going to be ad breaks and all that kind of stuff. I just thought that I was going to have to talk for 2 hours.
Just 2 hours nonstop.
So I ended up spending all weekend just poring over all, like, you should see my notes here, Ben. I've got all these stories. But what's really exciting about it is I ended up finding some stories that, because I was just going to talk about some stuff we've spoken about, but I found some outlying stories that I've never covered before that I thought, oh, this is great. I could put them into the show later on. But I didn't realize either that it was going to be on the phone. We didn't even have a phone line. So I had to set up the phone and sit on this handheld phone for 2 hours while I was doing Coast to Coast. But look, overall, it was fantastic.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, it was fantastic. George is really great.
I haven't heard it because I don't have an account with them, so
yeah,
I can't hear it.
Right. I mean, all that basically happened, I was just telling some of the history of Mysterious Universe, how you and I met, you know, some of our writers, that kind of stuff. One thing that did kind of throw me as well is that there was a sudden call-in, and we abandoned our call-in number years ago. And so all of a sudden these people call in, and some guy is like, oh, have you ever wondered because the Ouija board was produced in Australia and dolls? I'm like, what? Like, I had no idea.
What was the question?
I couldn't even understand it. It was something to do with an Ouija board being manufactured in Australia by an Australian company or something.
Well, if you were on in the afternoon here, it would have been like 3 a.m. when this person was calling you.
About that, yeah.
So were they coherent?
Well, yeah, he was. The woman afterwards wasn't so coherent. I think there was a little bit of alcohol potentially involved. And that was a bit of a shock. And I said something along the lines of, as we were describing stories from here in Australia where people have been sucked underwater by aquatic entities, essentially. Yeah. There seem to be, you know, haunted bodies of water here in Australia.
Was she like, I'd like to suck you underwater?
No, nothing like that. It was more like, oh, there's a fake lake here. This fake lake is like, pulls people under. And I was like,
fake lake?
Yeah.
And I said, what is a fake lake?
I said, oh, have you seen or heard of any stories about entities? What? And George goes, entities, have you seen any entities? Oh, there's one right here. And he was just like lying next to me and I pulled the sheet away. I was like,
like, what is a fake lake?
I don't know what a fake lake is. Maybe
it's really a dam, but it's pretending to be a lake.
It was fun. It was fun to go to do something live because I think it's been a long time since we've done anything that was live.
It was great that you could do it because I was a bit bummed that I couldn't do it. And Jeremy Corbell organized it as well, so thanks to him. But it was just awesome that you could get on there. And then our Facebook stats just exploded, apparently.
Yeah.
After you went on.
But it's
not on the website for some reason. It's like everyone that listens to Coast only uses Facebook.
It's kind of funny, though, because I'm not really interested. I know, obviously, I want to get the word of MU out there, but I don't have any intention. I just like doing this job because I get to sit and chat with a friend and talk about stuff that I really enjoy. I'm not really, you know, driven by doing other shows and that kind of stuff, which is
I thought your mission was to get the truth out about dog men.
No, I mean, people need to find these, you know, the truth, whatever the truth is for themselves. But although I'm happy to tell you a couple of stories along the way so you can work it out for yourself. And on that note, actually, so because I was preparing for this segment and George had suggested that I bring a little bit of Australian flavor into some of the stories that were getting close to Halloween, if I could find a couple of things. And I was going through some old archives that I have, some old archive footage of some of the stuff that we've put on the show before. If you recall, I covered some of the work of a former South African parapsychologist. So this guy was by the name of Morris Marsh, and he moved to Australia in the late 1980s, I believe. And when he came over here, he did a whole heap of parapsychological research. I believe he was based at a leading university in Sydney at one point. And the way that he kind of got into his research was that he was doing abnormal psychology. He wasn't interested in the paranormal unless he maybe had a fleeting interest in it. But he was doing abnormal psychology as lecturing. And he was under the impression at the time that abnormal psychology kind of fit quite well with paranormal psychology because people that see this kind of stuff are more inclined to have some type of emotional disturbance or something.
Is that true?
Not at all. He very quickly realized that that's not the case at all.
Right, I didn't think so.
No, of course not. I mean, this comes, I guess, from some of the preconceived notions that some people have. And obviously, I mean, that's a very, you know, nutshell kind of description of what happens. Obviously, this guy has been doing this for a long time. But he said he worked out that at least one in five of his students over the years had some type of serious paranormal experience.
Wow.
So that's a lot. You know, one in five, that's a huge amount of number to have these experiences. And the story that I discussed on the show, I played some audio from, was of these three women that lived in a house in Brisbane. And if you recall the story, these three women moved into this house. They were just sharing the house together, young girls, and they started having weird activity going on inside the home. They'd hear footsteps walking through the house. They would see fleeting figures out of the corner of their eye. They would wake up at night to find it, and of course it escalated. They'll wake up at night to find hands around their throats. And of course, when they go and check themselves in the mirror, they'd find that there'd be a red mark around their throat. They'd be scratched. And it all accumulated with this woman called Maria. And Maria woke up one night in this home in Queensland. And being in Queensland, because it's quite hot here, there's a house known as a Queenslander. So it has like these very open verandas and kind of slats that you can see through. And one evening she woke up and she felt compelled to look out through the louvers. And there was one that was missing. And if you recall the story, when she looked out through this louver, she said there was this skinny, skeletal, kind of disgusting gray man that was sitting in the tree. It was just sitting in the tree there, and it was kind of looking up to the moon and then looking back at her and staring her in the eye. And it did this five or six times, and she's blinking, trying to think that I must be hallucinating, I'm still dreaming, but she's like, no, I'm very much awake. And eventually this thing just kind of disappeared from the tree. But you know, Morris did a lot of research into this, and he was convinced that these women did have a genuine experience. So I continued with the research that he had done. And he uncovered this story from the township of York. So York is in the Avon Valley. This is in the Western Australian, it's just on the edge of the Western Australian desert. It's about 97 or something kilometres east of Perth. And back in the 1800s, the 1880s, this town was flourishing because it was a staging post for the gold rush.
Okay.
So it was like, you know, people would come in and they get their supplies. It was essentially like a servo spot for, you know, their supplies. But a train line went into that area in the late 1890s, like 1894 onwards. And when this train line went in, it kind of just circumvented this town. So this town all of a sudden just had a massive drop in their economy, and it became a very poor kind of area. And this hospital was built around this time. The plans for the hospital had already gone in when it was economically viable, so it was already being built. But by the time it was built, all the economy had dropped off. So being back in the late 1800s, the hospital really only serviced people that were poor, essentially. Anyone that was wealthier, the way that surgery was conducted back then, it would be if you were wealthier, you would have people come to your home. They'd even perform surgery on the kitchen table or in your bed. That was kind of the upper levels of medicine back then. But this story relates to this old York hospital. And it was built and kind of shut down after a few years. It was formerly the site of a convict depot, and it was placed next to the town cemetery. So already it sets off this location for having a haunted reputation, because when it was put on top of a convict depot, convicts just copped it really badly. Apparently, according to some of the stories, they were whipped and there was a lot of suffering and a lot of people died at this location. So you can see why already it's got the classic haunt kind of style about it. But essentially, the ownership in the 1980s, it was January of 1980, but before that, the ownership of this old hospital, which was now dilapidated, transferred to the Western Australian government, and the Western Australian government turned it into a youth hostel, or just a hostel. And so when this place turned into a hostel, essentially you could rent it out, and they would rent it out to community groups and that kind of thing. And so there was this one community group that was headed up by a woman by the name of Joan Harrison. So Joan Harrison was connected with a group here called Little Athletics. And so that's basically, it's exactly what it's described as. It's young kids.
Yeah, you know, I remember that from school.
Yeah, that would go out and, you know, you'd do all your track and your field and all that kind of stuff. And it would be something you'd do on the weekends. And so occasionally, being part of this club, essentially, you could also go on camps and do this kind of stuff. So it wasn't just athletics. It would also be a social thing. So there was 28 kids that was part of this little group that Joan Harrison was heading up. And they came up with this idea that they were going to run a camp, and the camp was going to be at this hostel about 100 miles or 100 kilometres, you know, outside of Perth. So in January of 1980, five adults and 28 children go to this camp. And when they get there, there's this essentially a groundskeeper who hands them the keys. And even though it's a big building, it's not huge. It's three stories or two stories and an attic. And they say to Joan, who was the oldest person there, they say, look, Joan, you can go anywhere you want in the house, anywhere at, in the hospital, but please just don't go upstairs. And she thought, oh, okay, yeah. She didn't really think there was anything of it. It must have been like, because it was an older building, and it, even though it had been kind of repaired and renovated, upstairs may have been dilapidated. So she said, that's fine. That's not a problem at all. So they go in, these 28 kids, they set up their little cots and they start settling down for the evening.
What a weird place to go for a school camp.
It's weird, isn't it?
Well,
it's,
what is going on?
Apparently, it was the only facility at the time that could house up to 28 kids because it had dormitories in it. So it can't...
Just go camping.
I know. Yeah, well, that's what I would think as well. But
take your tents.
Who knows?
I don't get the premise of this story.
I don't know why. Apparently, this is what they did.
Hey, kids, we're going to this haunted mental asylum for a field trip.
They didn't know it was haunted, and it was already an established hostel. So it kind of makes sense that they would just look. And of course, it's the 1980s. You'd go into the Yellow Pages.
Yeah, sure.
You'd open up hostel and be like, oh, there, go there. So regardless, though, they go this night. Now, Joan points out, Joan Harrison, she says that particular evening, the temperature was 47 degrees Celsius. That is hot. I don't know what it is in Fahrenheit, but I think that's actually over 100, well over 100 in Fahrenheit. And this is at night. I mean, that's really hot. I think the hottest that I've ever gotten in Queensland is about 42. So this is incredibly hot. And at night. So while she's there, she's got these four other adults with her, but she's got Maureen Kramer and she's got Paul Harrison. So Paul Harrison is her son. And she said, and they're both adults, but she says to her son, look, can you just go and check upstairs and just see if there's anywhere that the kids can sleep upstairs, because it's so hot down here. And it was hot and stuffy. There was all these big verandas upstairs and they thought they could open all the doors, and being up a little bit higher, you would catch the breeze. So Maureen and Paul say, yeah, okay, we'll go up and check. So they go up these doors or these stairs. And when they go up these stairs, they come to these big doors that have big glass plates in them. And they go through these doors. And they said that there was something about it. They just felt that there was something that was very uncomfortable. They thought that there was a vibe about it. But neither Paul nor Maureen wanted to talk to each other about it. So they took their torches and they started walking up through the halls. They couldn't find a light switch, which already makes it spooky enough as it is. But they come to this fireplace, which was in the center of this hospital. And they both swear that when they turn their torches onto the fireplace, the batteries are drained in both of the torches. See, I'm waiting for the sound effect. Yeah.
Ooh.
That's nothing, right? Because the moment that the lights go out, again, Halloween, but they swear...
Why are you doing a Halloween story on the 27th of October?
Because it's just a story I had ready for Coast to Coast, and I thought it was good, so I'll put it into plus because I didn't get to tell it. So they claim that as soon as this happens, this terrible moan seems to come down through the top of this fireplace, obviously from upstairs, but there's no wind. When it's that hot, there's no wind. So they start feeling very uncomfortable, and they said following this noise, this kind of moan, they claim that there's this stench, there's this horrible odour that comes down with it. And they go, because they feel like they're going to be vomiting, they go running down the stairs. Now, when they go running down the stairs, they said they can hear this horrible what seems to be like a woman screaming or moaning in pain as it happens. So they go back downstairs and they say to Joan, there's something up there. We both experienced something. This is very strange. We can't go anywhere up there. And Joan, being this very matter-of-fact kind of woman, she's like, you're being ridiculous. That is so stupid. But she didn't bother to investigate. She's like, oh, well, then we'll just keep all the kids downstairs. So that evening, they keep all the kids downstairs. No other noises, no other activity takes place. So maybe their, I guess, maybe imaginations have gotten away with them. The following morning, though, Joan Harrison claims that she gets this crockery pot, like just a jug, like a ceramic jug out, and she puts it on the bench and she goes over to the fridge to get the milk out to pour it into the pot so that she can give it out to the kids. And she says, as she does this, she turns around and she said she sees the pot start sliding off the table on its own accord. And as it does, it actually floats across the room and smashes on the floor. It doesn't lift up, but just kind of stays at the same level as it comes across from the table. So she's like, oh, no, I didn't. It must just have been the wind. But they're inside, the very inside of the hospital. There was no way that wind could come through. So she... You're taking away the fear. So anyway,
I think that's a very suitable sound effect.
It probably is a suitable sound effect for that. But the reason why I want to mention this case is, as much as you're making light of it, I think there's something very genuine about this. Because the way that Morrison had done his research, he was looking very deeply into these cases. He investigated each of these witnesses.
You got a lot of eyewitnesses. What was it, 26 kids or something?
28 kids and 5 adults. So all this strange activity is taking place, but then they hear this terrible scream upstairs. And this little girl comes running downstairs. Well, yes, that kind of scream. She comes running down the stairs and she has this slashed wrist. Now, they have to take her to
A
slashed wrist.
Okay.
One of the girls that was there on the camp. Now, she gets taken to hospital. She gets 5 stitches. Fortunately, it's not deep. But Joan goes and asks her and she says, what happened? What was going on?
Was it across the wrist or down the wrist?
It was across the wrist.
So she's just doing it for attention.
She didn't do it. So it was witnessed. This is the thing. It was witnessed by the other kids. They claim, because kids being kids and being boisterous, they went up the stairs. And when they went up the stairs, they said, these kids didn't know anything about the other activity that had taken place with the adults, because obviously the adults aren't going to try and scare the kids. They said that they saw this little girl be lifted up and flung through one of those doors, and she cut her wrist on that glass that I was describing before.
Oh.
Where the other two had gone in, Paul and Maureen had gone through previously.
I take back my poor joke.
Well, it was a terrible joke, but I just glossed over it. So with the door, though, they were saying that the height of the door where the glass was, it was at least 4 feet above the ground. So there was no way she could have just simply accidentally put her hand through the glass. She had to be lifted up by something. And these kids claim that she was flung across the room. So after this happened, they felt kind of stuck, because further to obviously making the mistake of booking yourself into a haunted youth hostel.
Yeah, what do you do?
Well, what happened was is that very first night, Joe was like, I have to pretend like nothing bad's happening, because they'd booked this cab thing, like this van that had dropped everyone off, and they wasn't coming back for a week. And there's no mobile phone.
Stuck there.
Yeah, they couldn't call. They're stuck there. So she's like, we've got to keep it quiet. So she keeps everything calm. And strange things are happening, and she tries to find out what's happening through her son. And she says to her son, go back upstairs and see what you can find.
So on the first night, a student gets thrown through a glass window, cuts herself, has to go to hospital, and they're like, we can't tell anyone about this. The kids will be upset. Are you serious?
It was 1980, right? Could you imagine the whole working with children stuff that we would have today if you pulled that kind of garbage? Like, back in 1980, though, things were very loosey-goosey.
But surely there was a telephone there. They could have just called the company to come and pick them up again.
You would think so. You would think so. So ultimately, things do die down, though, and things become quiet. But what the son had found is that where this smell was coming from, it was actually coming from the entrance to the attic. And there were strange noises that were coming from this attic, like a shuffling noise. But they thought, it's wind. It's wind, even though there was no wind. So the ultimate conclusion comes when Joan had still been in complete denial. She's just like, no, it's just, this is nothing. Until the final night, she claims that Joan herself sees a floating apparition that moves down the stairs. And then they hear this explosion that they thought was a water heater exploding out the back of the hospital. So them, the children, the adults, they all go running to the back of this building. And Joan claims, and this is according to Marsha's research, that while everyone was looking where this explosion was, she felt compelled to look out this side door, which had these curtains on it. Now, she claims that she pulls the curtain back and there's a fat matron standing there. She says it was this portly, fat matron, but spectral in form. So she just puts the curtain back. Talk about being in complete denial. She just puts the curtain back. She's like, good evening, everybody, and goes to bed. But what was great about this story, and of course the following morning is that they all left, but Morris did some really great research into this building. At the time, they had no way of knowing this because obviously a lot of this stuff is buried deep inside archive records. But he found out that room that was being, you know, the smell was coming from, that room was actually called the dying room or the morgue. The hospital didn't have a real morgue, just hadn't been built. So anyone that had died or anyone that was close to dying, they would place them up in this attic space. And that's where a lot of people would die. And apparently the matron there at some point in its history had been murdered by a violent patient. And she now, according to some of the stories backed up by other people as part of the Historical Society for that region, was saying that reports come in that apparently there's this fat matron who, and it's like that typical image of a matron that you think of from, you know, back in those times, just wandering through the halls, moaning as if she's unhappy or, kind of stuck in this location. So very kind of typical for a haunting. But what I liked about the case is that, it all sounds a little bit cliche, but they didn't have any knowledge of this stuff when they went in there. And it was only after the parapsychologist looked into its history, without telling them, was he able to validate some of the experiences that they had. So certainly really unusual stuff. And I've got a lot more from him. I need to do a little bit more research into some of his stuff because I think he's done really great work. He was the guy that found out the story about the bikini ghost. Do you remember that?
The bikini ghost?
Yeah, remember the bikini?
Rings a bell.
From Adelaide? So there was a woman by the name of Di Close.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and she built this brand new house, and it wasn't typical for a haunting. This is something he points out. And all of a sudden, one day, this woman walks through a house, and it's a woman in a bikini. And it was, like, aggressive. It caused all this strange kind of activity in the home. And the reason why that story was so amazing is because she wanted to have her family and friends thought she was going nuts. So she'd had these parties. And one of her friends, it was a husband and wife, they brought their adult son along. And this adult son, when he was there, he saw this woman kind of looking at him and kind of giving him the, let's meet. And he was like, oh, okay. So he saw her get up from the chair and then come back walking through the kitchen. And when she walked through, she was wearing a bikini. And she went outside into the pool and started swimming in the pool, trying to lure him into the water. And by the time that he went to touch her, she disappeared.
He did try and touch her.
Well, he tried to reach out and she just vaporized because there was someone, like a friend apparently came out looking for him and yelled out his name. And that almost just disrupted this kind of scene. But there was some speculation that this ties in with this idea. And this is what we're talking about in Coast to Coast. This idea of these very evil water spirits, water possessing spirits that try to lure people to their death.
That's the archetype, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely it is.
So when you were on Coast to Coast, did you play silly sound effects as well?
No, of course. I was on a phone line. I couldn't even do anything. I couldn't even play screams or anything.
Well, over the weekend, I was thinking about it. And if they get us on in the future, I figured out a way for us to hook our studio gear up to their telephone connection.
I don't know why we didn't think of that beforehand.
Maybe if you go on next time, I won't say anything. I'll just pretend I'm not there. And you just keep telling the cheesy stories and I'll just fire in horrible sound effects.
Or we could just do that on our own show, which is what we're doing for you right now.
Well, it's interesting you're bringing up the fae stuff as well.
Yeah, I've got a couple of stories that I want to go into because it's kind of consistent with the water spirit idea because fae folk have been said to be water possessing spirits as well, and they try to lure people to their death.
And something you mentioned about the stick like grey entity in the tree reminds me of some stuff I've got coming up. I picked up a new book from Alexander Rowland called Finding Fairies, Discovering Spirits, Pixies, Red Caps, and Other Fantastical Creatures in an Urban Environment.
Oh.
It's all about urban fairies.
Mm.
You know, they're like breakdancing, we're doing hip hop.
Wow. That's so dated. That's
urban fairies. So I was intrigued by this. And the book has a really great aesthetic. It's a nice design. The font select, I know this is super nerdy, but the font selection is really nice.
Who cares? What?
It's actually, I was reading the Kindle version, but as I started reading it, I thought to myself, oh, this would be a really nice physical book to hang on to.
This is luxurious.
No, just really, no, it's got this really nice design and aesthetic to it, which kind of drew me into it. But she starts off by describing the liminal world where the Fae dwell. So she talks about the liminal world being a place between places and points out very early on, the fairy, you know, the Fae folk, they're not in this specific location in our world. They're not in this physical location, obviously. She says that the liminal world lies alongside our world, you know, offset, it's slightly askew. Another dimension is a simpler way to say it, but that's how she describes it. And because this book is about fairies in an urban environment, she points out that the liminal places in our modern world where you'd likely find Fae are truck stops.
Yeah, it's true.
She says that in the modern world, one of the most liminal spaces is the truck stop. It is, as above, a place between places rather than a place in and of itself. Travelers stop there briefly, they move on and usually forget about it, or at the very least, their memories blur to indistinctness. Now, she compares this to, you know, the ancient or the folklore idea of these liminal places, but also points out subway cars are a strongly liminal place. People are just passing through. It's all about, there's an impermanence to it.
Transience.
Bridges, tunnels, hallways, even doctors' waiting rooms and service queues. I found that weird. The idea that you're going to come across a gnome, some kind of fae creature, while you're waiting to see the doctor?
Well, is she implying that the presence of like a transitionary space grants access to this reality? Is that what she's kind of saying?
She's not very clear on it.
Okay.
I did like the idea of sitting down in a doctor's office and just seeing like maybe some creepy old man who looks really sick, and you just leave thinking, man, that guy looked really sick. But really, it was just a creepy old gnome. It was like some old gnome. That's just what he looks like. But Roland, she's kind of hesitant to point this out. Because, you know, that these places are where you have this crossover of realms, so to speak, because it's dangerous. It's dangerous for people to seek out the Fae folk. It's dangerous for people to have these encounters. And she gives an example from history. There's the story of the Abbot Edwin of Locksley. It's this really early account that he wrote in 1127. He wrote this letter to his local duke and said, "Your Grace, Tuesday last, I was on the road to visit you, and it was good weather, and I was walking by foot, and I decided to cut through the wood." And he describes coming across these merry poachers and how they were wearing bright colours and they were playing music that he had never heard before, and all of a sudden this conservative, you know, abbot was doing a jig with these poachers. And he said, "Indeed, they called out to me and seemed very pleasant and friendly, but I only replied, 'I cannot stop. I am expected at the Duke's house.'" And he says, "It was only the thought of my destination that hurried me onwards. Otherwise, I expect I would have tarried with them." So he would have hung out at this party. And he said, when he emerged from the wood, he suddenly found himself on the doorstep of his abbey. And he thought, what am I doing here? I was on my way to the Duke's house. And it was early morning.
I was going to say, does he have missing time?
The next day.
Yeah.
It's just this really weird letter from 1127 where he's basically saying to the Duke, like, "Please forgive me not showing up at your dinner party. I swear I set out to be there.
I assure you I was not drunk on mead."
But maybe this was an excuse you would use in the 12th century.
Well, that you got distracted by gnomes?
Maybe. Maybe it was this guy was known for having really boring dinner parties.
Like the polite kind of thing to do. So you can't rock up. So you just, like, instead of saying, "Oh, my mother was ill," it's, "I was accosted by gnomes."
Yeah. But at least it is this record from history of this missing time being kind of, what's the word, glamoured in the woods by these strange, colourful entities. And it's a great story. But sadly, this is one of the only stories she includes in the book.
What do you mean?
There's just nothing in it.
So how can you write a book about fae folk encounters?
Well, she has another notable text she mentions of this obscure American essayist, L.C. Parsons. He died sometime in the late 1870s, she said, where he had apparently visited the ferry several times until the construction of a railroad cut through the woods he would use to access the fairy realm, which she points out permanently destroyed this doorway there. And I'm reading it going, cool story. I can't wait to hear about this. And she never mentions anything about it. She doesn't explain it. She doesn't explain what he wrote. She doesn't describe what he described. It's just completely left out.
So if it's about fairies and urban settings, then what's the rest of the book about?
You're about to find out, my friend. She starts to talk about these doorways that exist in various places and have been operating until recently or recent modern times that have been kind of shut down, portals into the Fae realm, if you will, that have been made defunct. And she just starts listing them, like in Los Angeles, apparently Griffith Park, near the abandoned zoo. This was first documented as a kind of portal to a fairy world in 1922, but went defunct in 1975.
Why? What happened in 1975?
I have no idea! You think you're writing a book about fae folk encounters, you would include the encounters.
Did they build something? Did a stadium go in? What's there?
I don't know. Maybe this is the most mysterious universe ever. Because she doesn't include any stories. She says it was accessible for 4 days after the full moon, starting 90 minutes before the moon reaches its zenith and lasting 90 minutes afterwards. Signs included the sounds of distant laughter and wind instruments. And she says, bring a loaf of very good bread.
That's very specific to describe the time that the portal will be open and then yet not describe why it was closed.
It's like, you know what kind of baked goods to bring to the portal, but you have no other references about the portal.
Bring a croissant.
New York City, and this is the second one, Central Park. Apparently there's a stand of trees by the pond near the Delacorte Theatre. First documented in 1985. Again, no story. It went defunct. The portal closed down in 1994.
Why?
Again, we don't know. But she has all these details that are meaningless because the portal's been closed.
You know what? You need to give me access to the soundboard because that deserved a dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. She says, notes, accessible for 30 minutes at dawn on the equinoxes. Extremely difficult to locate. Signs include the rustling of leaves when there's no wind or a faint meowing. Impossible to pass through if the traveller was wearing shoes with laces or the colour grey. But again, that's it.
But
and the third portal that is apparently shut down is in London. This is the Big Ben, the Elizabeth Tower, the panes of glass that make up the numeral 8 on the eastern clock face. That's apparently a fae portal. It was first documented January the 6th, 1878. It went defunct. The portal closed down May the 10th, 1941.
Very, very specific. Is that when a bomb fell on it?
I would love to know the answers to these questions.
How do you even get a specific date as to when the portal is first? Well, obviously someone had to walk through it.
How do you even get published? Is the question I was asking. And then again, there's these notes that are just useless information. Like, opened for one chime of the bell at midnight every other Thursday and requires the traveller to be carrying a shilling in every pocket of their clothing. Okay. Great.
How do you know that?
What's
this arbitrary information? Like, where does it come from?
I'm looking for those little numbers that tell me references so I can maybe find this information. No, none of that. So, again, no stories, no eyewitness accounts, no folklore references, nothing. Then she goes on this bizarre direction on internet fae. And because I feel like she's given the book this purpose, that it's about urban fairies, she has to write about modern example,
sure.
Modern things. So she points out that traditional folk wisdom holds strong in terms of talking to the fae. Don't do it. You know, don't interact with them. Don't talk to fairies. Don't talk to beings who might be fairies. Don't talk to some weird guy you meet at midnight at the crossroads who offers you powers.
Could be low-level entities. Could be demonic.
Could be the devil.
Bad news.
Just ignore them.
Yep, devil, you're right.
But she says it's never that simple though, is it? Never mind the fact that many of you will think, but I'm an expert. I know what I'm doing. Well, we're definitely not an expert after reading your book, lady. The Fae are, above all, a reflection of human nature, she says, and they go where humans go. They have been carried from continent to continent as if travellers have hauled them along in back pockets. And that's kind of true. Like, if you look at immigrants to the United States bringing European folklore and culture with them, we start to see fairies and
the same thing happened here.
and weird little creatures turning up in the Americas. And she asks, well, where are humans going now? And she says, mostly the internet. Internet fairies. Now, liminal beings, she points out, can be any shape, energy or vibration. There can be an ether, an echo. Some can be touched, some can be captured, but many more are just nebulous like ghosts. And she says it's right there in the name. They are called liminal because they are not quite anchored onto this plane. It is therefore only to be expected that they would follow us even into abstraction, and thus we have fairies of information. Fairies of bites as pulses of electricity and magnetic blips.
That's very abstract, though. I don't necessarily think that's... It doesn't work for me.
I love this idea. I love the idea of there being entities in information, the idea of, electricity being alive. I really like this concept.
Why does it have to be a fairy, though? Can't it just be some type of panpsychism?
Well, we know that fairies is like a catch-all phrase for any kind of other entity. But she says with this maxim of don't talk to fairies, it suddenly becomes moot, because these days you might be talking to a person and they might be a fairy. She says you might not even know that you're talking to one. And this is where I'm like, really? What? Someone's emailing you from your electricity company and it might be a fairy?
Is it a euphemism for bots?
I don't know where she's going. Well, I didn't. She said the maxim must be discussed with greater care rather than intoning a few dire warnings and leaving you to the mercy of your common sense. So you might be chatting unknowingly on some app you use to a fairy right now. And she kind of compares this to the folklore of the danger of entering into bargains with these entities, inviting them in. You know, they still follow those old rules, but if they're using a new medium, it suddenly opens up all these dangers.
What is this, like To Catch a Predator fairy style or something?
Well, she says, historically, one of the most dangerous things you can do is to agree to the dreaded terms and conditions, right? The modern version of that is just you're on a website and you agree to the terms and conditions. Like you download an app.
That's such a stretch.
What if the software developer is a fairy or some kind of fae creature?
I can't buy that. That's too abstract.
It's at this point of Finding Fairies by Alexander Rowland where I'm thinking, is she a troll? Is this a joke? Have I been hoodwinked? Is this some kind of in-joke that I'm not getting?
No,
but
maybe.
The rest of the book is very kind of, you know, cookie cutter. Here's like a brownie and here's like a house troll and here's what they do. And just, you know, very kind of like fairy encyclopedia stuff.
There's a big difference between believing that you've got some type of house entity in your home that cleans up when you go to bed, as opposed to a fairy developing software with terms and conditions that you have to agree to.
And then I start reading further and I think, no, she's got to be joking. She's got to be a troll, because she has this section on how to unsubscribe if a fairy gets your email address. She says, look, the safest option is to install a browser extension like FayBlock or SaltLine.
Does FayBlock actually exist?
No.
Oh.
I had a good look for it. I went to the Chrome add-on store, but you can tell other people have been looking for it who have probably read this book, because once you start typing it, it comes up as an auto-suggestion.
It does too. And what was the other one? You said SaltLine.
SaltLine, as in, you know, you draw a circle of salt to protect yourself from spirits. Neither of these things exist. So is she saying hypothetically there could be an extension like that? Is she saying... Because I don't think she's saying they exist, although that's how it reads. But she says, if problems still occur, you have to go to greater lengths. If your email server has the ability to set decorative background images, try using one with warding runes or ceiling circles. And if a fairy might outright hack your account, like if a fairy hacks your Gmail, for example, the most effective tactic is to ask your friends to spam your inbox with infinitely looping GIFs. Now, you might think, why? Why is this helpful? She says, we believe this works on the same principle as casting grains of wheat on the ground as a confusion tactic. so that the fae creature will have to stop to count them out individually. This must be an old thing from folklore. You know, you throw a bunch of rice and it's probably like an old yokai thing as well. You throw a bunch of rice and the yokai's got to stop and count every grain of rice.
All I'm hearing is liberal arts degree here.
This is the same thing. There's just looping gifs over and over that mesmerizes the fae entity that's hacked your Gmail. And then you can take your account back.
Are you listening to how insane this sounds?
Again, I'm asking myself repeatedly this afternoon, this is a joke, right? No. She goes on, she continues on how to exercise your devices. So if your iPhone, for example, has become possessed by some kind of fae entity, like a hobgoblin or something has gotten into your into your iPhone storage, you have to draw an 8-pointed star around the infested device. Then surround the star with a ring of salt, followed by a ring of rice. Set a lit candle inside each of the points of the star and announce politely, like you don't want to be rude to the entity that's possessed your device, that you would like it to leave. Oh, please, fairy, can you please leave my iPhone? I need it back so I can shitpost on Twitter. That's what you got to do. Then you extinguish the candles without touching them and leave the iPhone in the circle until its battery runs out. Once the battery's dead, it's safe to retrieve it and you can continue with your sad life. if possible, keep a potted holly plant close by where you charge your device. Otherwise, keeping the devices not currently in use on a surface made of holly or chestnut wood will work as well. Himalayan salt rock lamps, are an effective preventative measure as long as they're in close proximity. And they also, she adds this little sentence at the end, other people that come to your house won't realize that you're a crazy person. She doesn't say it that way, but that's what she's implying. The rock salt lamp is a subtle way to dispel fairies from your iPhone. Then she just waffles on about brown. Like, there's all this craziness, and then it's just cookie cutter fairy encyclopedia stuff. Like, a brownie lives in your house and it keeps your bread and milk lasting longer.
But it doesn't sound like it's based on any, like, I understand with some fae folk, you know, stories and even, you know, ways to defeat them, it's based on some form of tradition, some form of, you know, long-standing, you know, understanding about how we interact with these things. You can't just be like, oh, we'll just draw a pentagram and throw your phone on it and throw some salt at it.
Well, that probably was a folklore tradition to get rid of the possession on your horse cart or something.
Can I ask the question, how do you know that your iPhone is possessed anyway? What does it do that makes you go, oh, I've got a hobgoblin in there?
I don't know. Maybe you just keep seeing pictures of Hunter Biden's penis or something just over and over again.
It doesn't count if you look it up deliberately.
So she says the biggest urban issue with brownies, like she has to wedge in this urban angle on the end of it. It's like she's gone and just copy and pasted an encyclopedia on fairies and then just stacked onto the end of it this urban angle. So with brownies, and brownies, of course, are entities that, you know, live in your house.
Yeah.
And part of the idea was you would leave out food or, you know, a bit of milk or whiskey for them and they would do little favors for you, like keep the spiders away.
They were the old versions of Roombas.
Yeah, that would make sure your milk doesn't expire as quickly and your bread lasts a little bit longer.
Keep your whites white.
All that kind of stuff. But she says today in the urban environment, because people now live in apartment buildings, the brownie that's generated only applies to the apartment building. So she says if you go to all this effort to keep the brownie happy, like if you leave out whiskey and some cookies for the brownie, it might then go to the next floor up and look after their apartment. It won't necessarily look after your apartment.
Well, that's a bad deal.
Her argument is it's not worth the effort because they're not specific to your apartment. They just randomly look after people in the building, which is very practical advice.
You could do it for altruistic purposes.
Yeah, but you can see the level of effort that's gone into this. She talks about holder folk, black dogs, red caps. Again, nothing really that interesting.
So what happens when a black dog gets loose in your apartment building?
Well, the urban angle, I can't even remember what her urban angle on that was. It was just the same stuff we've read about black dogs before.
Well, black dogs are omens of death.
Yeah, exactly. But she didn't really have a new twist on it. She just kind of listed them. The other interesting thing was changelings don't exist.
But there's massive traditions about them.
No, it's a myth. Changelings are a myth. She says many scholars have realized this, but she never references the scholars or tells us who the scholars are.
But why is it a myth?
Because changelings in the past were just kids that had autism. And so families would say, oh, they're a changeling. And she says that scholars have identified the history of changelings is very similar to the common presentations of the disorder. So social disinterest, aversion to touch, eye contact, you know, low rates of speech acquisition, all the stuff with autism.
But that's only a small number of cases. If you look into the history of changelings, they physically are different.
Can you stop being so skeptical, please? I'm trying to do a segment here.
I just did a story about a haunted hospital with a fat matron.
I'm trying to do some serious scholarly presentation on this new tome. And then there's library fairies. She talks about the ink suckers, which I'd actually never heard before. Apparently, it leaves pages intact, but whenever someone comes and tries to read the book, it's completely incomprehensible. Like, everything's there. The words are all there. But the inkling has done something. The ink sucker has done something in another dimension to make the information gobbledygook.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've all experienced that. You got to try and read something, and you got to read it, you know, six or seven times, and you can't get the information out of it.
Yeah, yeah. That's the first time I heard that. I thought, that's kind of a cool idea. Again, no examples, no kind of expansion on that idea. Just solutions for how to solve it. She said what you want to do is when you put your bookshelf together, you have to use iron screws instead of modern kind of steel or zinc or anything like that, because iron repels fairies.
Of course, but where do you get iron screws from, especially not IKEA?
No idea. She says, if that doesn't work, you can bind the book using leather made from the skin of a lamb that was 30 days old and killed during a full moon.
That's terrible.
So can you imagine calling the hardware store and saying, have you guys got any iron nails? And they're like, no. While I'm calling, do you have any lambs that were killed under the full moon? I need to solve this ink fairy situation. So ridiculous, right?
It's a new book.
One type of fae being I haven't heard of, though, and this is where I thought, okay, this is going to be really fun to cover this, because even though a lot of this stuff so far is just really silly and absurd, that's fun. That's still fun to talk about the people that research this stuff.
Oh, even the theories are great.
So one I'd never heard of was the luck pigeon. This is what I mentioned in the intro, the mysterious luck pigeon. She says it's one of the poorest documented liminal beings in the world, but simultaneously, it is also one of the most fascinating, perhaps because it is so elusive. But most definitely, she says, because it is a supernatural creature that is limited exclusively to the urban environment of the last 200 years. It is a pigeon, she says. So I'm like, what? Hang on a second. It's just a pigeon? She says, it looks like a pigeon, it coos like a pigeon, it walks like a pigeon, weirdly unbothered by proximity to humans and will lazily leave off flying until the last possible moment, as real pigeons do. It does not have a burning glint of malice in its eye that would give it away, nor a sparkle of fairy dust along its wings, nor does it have a suspiciously concentrated pigeonly essence to set it apart from its kin. It really is a pigeon, she says. What? So it's just a pigeon? Is that this mysterious creature?
I'm lost. I don't understand. So it's not a pigeon, but it is a pigeon, and it's mystical.
She doesn't even explain it very well. I feel like that inkling demon has gone through her entire book and just made nothing.
I'll mess this up, bitch.
Nothing makes sense at all. She says, there's no way to know which pigeon in a flock the pigeon is, if any, and there seems to be only one pigeon at a time. So when she says that, I'm thinking, do you mean one mysterious the pigeon in the world or in the particular region? I think she means the world.
I'm going to go with the flock, because that makes it a little bit easier.
No, out there, there's this single pigeon that is the pigeon. And it looks and behaves just like every other pigeon, but it's not like every other pigeon. It's the pigeon.
And what happens if you find the pigeon? Is that what we're trying to do?
This is what the scholars hypothesize. But again, we have no idea who the scholars are. The scholars hypothesize, she says, that immediately upon the death of the pigeon, whatever force that makes it the pigeon instantly transports to another pigeon at a random location around the globe, whereupon that pigeon becomes the pigeon.
Oh, you're right. There's one.
Yeah, there's one.
It's like a Highlander pigeon.
So according to several social, this is where I was like, okay, I've got a segment here. According to several social media groups exclusively devoted to locating the pigeon, there is the Facebook group, The Pigeon Fanciers. There is the Tumblr blog, That Bird Though. There is the online forum, Pigeon Watch, and the Twitter hashtag, Is That the Pigeon? Now she says, as of this book's publishing, scholars believe the pigeon may currently reside in or near Baltimore, Maryland.
Based on?
Again, no information. Listen to me. Do you have any idea how many hours I spent this afternoon going through the fucking Pigeon Watch forum? Do you know how many hours I spent looking through, doing searches for, ooh, spooky pigeon in the Pigeon Watch forum? Do you know how many applications to the Facebook group, The Pigeon Fanciers,
oh,
I made today?
Oh, group as well.
Do you know how much time has been wasted from my life because of this pigeon? Maybe that's the effect of the pigeon. It just wastes your time. Part of the curse.
You're right, though. There actually is a Pigeon Watch forum, but is it just for watching pigeons? Like, people have got a weird pigeon fetish?
It's about shooting pigeons! It's not even about watching them.
No, so you're right. It is. It's a shooter's website.
It's a shooting website.
So what's this one? Pigeon Watch, pigeon shooting.
Woman's full of shit. I feel like this is the greatest troll of all time. I feel like she's just totally hoodwinked me with this.
What's pigeon chat? People actually sit around and chat about pigeons?
There is no reference to any of this.
Oh, races. Oh.
Anywhere. And it's a complete waste of time. She goes on to point out that if you mistreat or harass this, the pigeon,
the pigeon,
what's the horrible demonic thing that happens to you? Oh, you might miss a bus. It's just like, you might, miss the subway, or when you're driving home, you get more red lights than usual. Ooh!
I get all the sound effects. Where is it? Come on.
The sound effects?
I need at least one.
I don't have a pigeon sound effect.
Oh, I just need a dun.
You fucking bitches.
That'll do.
That works.
She says, as a corollary, one should be able to conclude that gaining the pigeon's favour through small gifts or pleasant manners would result in good luck. But as it is a pigeon, this is extraordinarily difficult to prove.
So what small gifts do you give to the pigeon?
Well, you don't know if it's the pigeon, so you have to basically always have some crackers in your... Like, imagine you're already a crazy cat lady, like this woman obviously is. So you've got enough pockets for little crumbly biscuits and things. So you're always just feeding the pigeons in case you don't want to upset the pigeon, in case one of the pigeons is the pigeon.
Who cares? You're going to miss a bus.
Yeah, I know. Ooh,
or the subway.
I might stub my toe. And she points out that the pigeon was actually temporarily captured by an amateur phase spotter named Jennifer Mace in 2014. Now, Mace has a blog post entitled, "You'll Never Guess What This Fucking Pigeon Did to Me."
Okay, I'll look that up.
She's apparently on Tumblr. This went viral in the pigeon tracking community and received, she says hundreds, but I'd like to say going viral in the pigeon tracking community.
I just saw there was like 30,000 people in this pigeon tracking forum.
That's people that like shooting pigeons. That's normal people.
Yeah, well, not the pigeon.
This isn't pigeon tracking is not people looking for a scary demon pigeon.
Perhaps not surprisingly, I cannot locate that blog.
Yeah, I spent all afternoon looking for it. I can't find it anywhere. She says this person received hundreds of responses, this Jennifer Mace, both attempting to debunk her claims or suggesting methods of conclusively proving whether the pigeon she had caught was indeed the pigeon. Unfortunately, before any experts could contact her, Mace had released her captive pigeon into the wild once more. Oh, what a fucking enlightening end to that story. Amazing.
Yeah, I think you're right. Because I was thinking this woman's just someone who's gotten too deep into esoterica and she's publishing her brain fart of ideas and concepts. And we can see some postmodernism bullshit going on here. But no, I actually think this woman's really smart.
I think it's
a troll.
I feel like she sat down and she thought, I'm going to write a book and I'm going to publish it in the new release occult section on Amazon because I know Benjamin Grundy will read it. And she's like, I know how to fuck with this guy.
I wouldn't give yourself that much attention, but it's
this whole thing is to mess with us because no one can be this dumb.
No, I don't think it's dumb. I could be completely wrong. I think, though, this is actually like messing with people to see, you know about people create, you know, the reason why a lot of people create false paranormal stories is because they want attention. They want to create, like, I created this meme or I created this idea. Maybe this is what she's trying to do. Maybe she's like trying to start the new Slender Man, but pigeon style.
But the rest of the book is so vanilla and so boring, I didn't even put it in my notes. Because
what was it? Just more encyclopedic references?
It's just, Faye references you could look up on any website, that there's nothing interesting and there's no stories. It's just a small paragraph about the particular entity. Like there's the Wendigo and she does the Native American stuff and it's just a paragraph. There's just nothing unique or interesting about it at all.
How surreal. I mean, maybe it's a combination. Maybe it's just someone very new to these topics as well. And she's kind of just...
That's most of the book. So I'm just picking out the stuff that I found inexplicable because the only reference I can find, there's no Jennifer Mace blog. There's nothing on Tumblr about this pigeon stuff. There's no Luck Pigeon Facebook group. None of these things exist. There's just regular pigeon people groups and they're usually people that want to shoot pigeons.
Is it self-published?
No, it's on Simon & Schuster.
Are you kidding?
The only reference I can find to any of her stories is the description on the Simon & Schuster website, where it's
they're
like...
They're a huge publisher.
For the first time, we get to hear about the unique luck pigeon that is confusing people around the world. And I'm just, what?
We really are at the end of society.
Anyone can write anything these days.
Yeah.
Later on, she talks about roadway spirits who follow ley lines, because apparently highways have crossed ley lines now, and these spirits that usually used to travel along ley lines, this is the modern version.
They now
will be along highways. Mm. And she has this description of air spirits, and again, very kind of vanilla, and we've heard it all before. But she says they apparently attack motorcyclists. It's very common for motorcyclists to be attacked by these air spirits on the highway. And she says, but it's okay because motorcyclists have figured out a way to ward off these air spirits. You know what they do? They get a little tinkly bell. They get a little tinkly bell, like something like this. And they put it on their motorcycle handlebars.
No, they don't.
I'm just like...
I just imagine, like, you've got a really nice bike. I couldn't see you putting a little tinkle bell on it.
Have you ever met a motorcyclist? Like, who are the people she knows that ride motorcycles? Does she mean the soy latte drinking little soy boy down the road who drives a little Italian scooter to the cafe every morning?
Check out my penny farthing motorcycle.
And he turns up and he's like, ding, 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 trying to ward off the spirits.
Talk
ding,
about
ding,
Facebook. Ding.
Is that who she's talking? Did you think that guy's a motorcyclist? Who is she talking about? There is no motorcyclist that's putting a little bell on their bike. Doesn't exist. It's like the pigeon.
But that's even an insult to people that enjoy that kind of soy latte lifestyle anyway. That's ridiculous.
I'm just saying, if they're at a soy latte drinking a pumpkin beverage or something and they're riding an Italian scooter and they've got a little bell on there, I don't think it's weird. But imagine a big guy on a chopper.
I know,
with a beard, and he's got his Sons of Anarchy jacket on, and he's got a little ding, 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 ding.
Oh, even a guy that's on a sports bike. He comes roaring past with Kawasaki. He's got ding, ding. Yeah.
It's ridiculous. So then we get to, I think, which is the clue as to what's going on here. We get to the intersectionality of the fairy. And it's funny because you knew it was coming.
I told you. I could feel a liberal arts degree coming towards
you. You knew it was coming. In recent years, she says, fairy scholarship has at last begun to acknowledge the vast amounts of potential contributions that native peoples and other marginalized groups can make to the field. Like, what are you talking about? People have been writing about native folklore since we've had natives. Like, we've always spoken about native folklore.
With a lot of respect as well. It's revered.
And European folklore is native folklore. What are you talking about? What do you mean marginalized peoples and their folklore? What does being marginalized have anything to do with their folklore? What are you talking about? So she says, indeed, there are some species that are impossible for certain demographics to see, even when they're in the same room as them.
Hang on, is this some weird, like, people don't see colour in the fairy world?
So, for instance, she says, consider the findings of the biologist Jean Blakeman, who in 1942 conclusively proved, first, that she had captured a banshee, and second, that her male colleagues found it impossible to gaze directly at the creature, notice it, or even after having it pointed out to them, remember the specifics of what it looked like.
In the 1940s, women were so invisible you couldn't see them, they were fairies.
So she's come up with this idea that only women could see a certain type of fae, like only women can see banshees. Now, she, at the end of this, she says famously, there was one exception to this rule. There was an L.M. Yarrow, who was Blakeman's young undergraduate assistant, who was a man, but came out as a trans woman 50 years later and could suddenly see the banshee.
I really hope you had sound effects for that. I was like, I'm a woman!
I mean, did he drop character when he saw the banshee? Or did he come into the room and be like, oh, hello, I have been so many years since I've seen you. Oh, fuck, that's a fucking banshee. I can see it. I can see that cunt right there. That's a banshee. I mean, no.
But you know what, though? It's really actually, I find that really disrespectful to trans people, because it's almost saying that, well, until you acknowledge, like, it's really forceful. I find it really disrespectful.
Do you?
Yeah, it's just ridiculous.
I just find it hilarious.
It's funny, but it's disrespectful as well.
And I'm like, this is a book about fairies, but it's complete nonsense, even for a book about fairies. And it's not because she's writing about fairies that makes it nonsense. She's talking about all these ridiculous intersectionality issues. And she's just like this Jean Blakeman person doesn't exist.
Yeah.
There's no Jean Blakeman capturing a banshee in 1942.
But this is pervasive in this. And look, intersectionality, when it was, reasonable, I kind of saw where it was. But now, like, it's just all make up facts. Just make it all up.
Now, the weird thing is she thanks all these people in the acknowledgements at the end of the book.
None of them exist. Are they fairies?
Do they exist in her head?
Did you look them up?
Yeah, of course I looked them up. Do you know how many Google searches I did this afternoon looking for this? Like, how many variations on banshee, tranny, Bateman, biologist I did this afternoon? There's zero results. There's nothing. I tried three different search engines. I thought maybe Google is blocking it for some reason, saying I'm calling trans people banshees. But no, I tried different search engines. I still get no results. I don't think this person exists. I don't think it's real. So later on, she tells us that the fae around Chernobyl, again, scholars have discovered, mutated behemoths because they're affected by the radiation. So there's fae entities that are like Hulk in other dimensions.
Hang on a second. Who gave her that information?
Scholars.
Which scholars?
I don't know. Probably.
Did she reference or she give her name?
Probably. I have no idea.
The pigeon.
Yeah. All the birds she's feeding every morning in the park. But we could find evidence in the acknowledgements that she's not trolling us. Again, the whole time I'm like, is this a master troll? Is this actually a master troll? Has she really taken us for a ride? If she has, bravo.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's true. I think she is just, in fact, retarded. And I'll explain why.
Please
she said, look, I wrote this book at my home in Western Massachusetts, the traditional ancestral homeland of the Nipmuc and the Pocantuk First Nations.
Yeah.
It is of vital importance to understand and acknowledge that the occupation of these lands was done through great and ongoing acts of violence. What ongoing acts of violence? What are you talking about? What ongoing acts of violence against the native people? She's a crazy person.
That would be terrible if that was true.
It's not true.
Illegal.
She's a crazy person. She says, I cannot simply refuse to participate in this because by my very position in society, I am a member of the occupying force and have benefited from the structural oppression of these and other marginalized communities.
So she's got severe white guilt.
I cannot ever fully opt out of these benefits. I can only choose again and again which side of the fight I am on. No, you actually can. Like, you actually can opt out. Why don't, if you feel like you've oppressed the native peoples, why don't you give them all your stuff?
Yeah.
If you actually believe that, what's stopping you? Nothing in society is stopping you.
Donate the proceeds of this book.
A very small gesture. No mention of that. So the rest of it's like, blah, 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 climate change. Blah, 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 America's founded on racism. Blah, 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 Marxism, 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 Marxism.
Is she that polluted by...
Yes, she's not
terrible,
a troll.
Insidious disease.
She's not a troll. She's a retard. But let me read you the final thing. She says, but the thing that burned in the pit of my stomach through all of this was the painful awareness of the fact that for hundreds of years, white supremacists have used European mythology and folklore as a tool to excuse or justify their atrocities.
No, they haven't.
While systematically destroying the mythologies of people around the world.
No, what are you talking about? On Coast to Coast, I actually spoke about a lot of the Native Australian mythologies. But they're high. I don't know what's going on in America in that regard.
How dare you?
But Australian mythologies of the native people are highly revered.
Of course they are.
And respected and preserved.
They're not only highly revered, they're idolized.
Yes.
Like, how many people worship Native Americans and the idea of their spirituality? This is just complete absurdity. The idea that European folklore is a tool of oppression.
No, it's complete Marxism. Complete
what
and utter.
What a joke.
Yeah.
And then finally, we get the icing on the cake when you read her bio. And
okay.
At first, it sounds normal. Like, Alexandra Rowland is the author of A Conspiracy of Truths, which is one of her earlier books, and its sequel, A Choir of Lies and Finding Fairies. They are also occasionally a bespoke seamstress under the stern supervision of their feline quality control manager. What do you mean they? They hold a degree in world literature, mythology, and folklore from Truman State University, and they are one of the three hosts of the Hugo Award-nominated literary podcast, Be the Serpent. So first of all, it's revealed she's a crazy cat lady because she has a feline quality control manager.
What is that?
I don't know. Just maybe the head cat in her apartment is her manager. She's got 20 cats. It's like a hierarchy of cats. And the biggest, most annoying cat, it gets to the top of the hierarchy and it basically becomes her literary agent and maybe gets her other information.
It's actually, I feel, I'm not going to cast aspersions upon her character, but from what I'm listening to, it sounds like there's a severe disconnect with reality.
Yeah, she's a lunatic. She's using the pronoun they. And the references in her book are just as made up as her gender. Like, they don't exist. There's no pigeon person. None of these Tumblr blogs exist that I can find. She acknowledges them in the end of her book. I don't think they're real people. I think she's just completely crazy. And Simon & Schuster is like, this is the latest, greatest study on the literary world of fairies.
But you can't make obviously on this show, like, I've referenced stuff that comes from forums and comes from people's stories. Like, I'm not trying to, you know, prove anything. But that sounds like, I mean, if you're writing something that seemingly is coming from an academic standpoint and you're referencing actual names of real people.
No, there's no references.
They should exist.
It's just hilarious. So I'll definitely link to this in the show notes, along with her Twitter feed. if you like hearing people screech online, her Twitter feed is divine. I recommend the podcast as well. I tuned into the Hugo Award nominated literary podcast, Be the Serpent, this afternoon. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have time to listen to the whole episode, the latest one, but I just kind of skipped through. They were honestly talking about fat women searching for bridal dresses. That was the first thing, that they're oppressed because they can't find large bridal dresses because they're too fat. So I just skipped ahead. Then they're talking about how to resist a coup in the United States and screaming at you to effing vote. Fine. They skipped ahead a little bit more. And then they're talking about how being trans means you're not allowed to be a vampire and that this is a problem with this.
What? And then if you're trans, you want to be a vampire, go for it.
And then this connected to how testing drugs on pregnant women is unfair because you can't call them women, you need to call them uterus owners. So then I was just, all right, I'm done for this. That's Finding Fairies by Alexandra Rowland. Highly recommended. I'll link to it in the show notes.
What the hell was that?
If you want to check it out. But the amazing thing was, again, this idea that European folklore is some kind of...
But do you see what this... You know what? Look, some people might be, you know, and it's fine, but there is this danger of this Marxist idea kind of infiltrating society. Like, it really is. And I'm not trying to be alarmist, like, but it is. It's a very dangerous way of thinking because what it's about... It's you know, said to be about tearing down structures, but structures and traditions give us the fabric of our society and we can grow as a society. Yes, we can grow. You shouldn't tear things down. So what this is all about is about destroying traditions. So if you change your tradition, like even folklore, and you make it out to be all about oppression, you actually are destroying the goodness that's in there.
And that's all it is. It's just dividing everything up between the oppressors and the oppressed, which is endlessly.
Which is the whole point. Like, if you, I mean,
which is not reality.
No, but if there is, like, the whole point of it is that you get this oppressor and oppressees, and then you divide society, and we're all fighting with each other, then the elites just make all the money and control us. That's the problem with this stuff.
So because that was so disappointing, I actually went to Simon Young's Fairy Census from 2014.
Oh, he's great.
And I remember you touched on this a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
When it first came out. It came out in 2018.
Yeah, it did. But it was so, well, it was kind of like, you're right, there was an original one and then there was a complete whole renewal which came out, you're right, in January of 2018. But this thing is huge. This is, if I can't recall, it's at least hundreds of pages, isn't it? It's really, really big.
Well, over 160,000 words about these encounters.
Oh, that's what it is.
Basically, it was fairiest.com. It was this ongoing questionnaire. I think it's still live today. Like, you can still contribute to it and they'll publish new reports in the following years. But they had got so many reports, the editor, Simon Young, decided, I've got to put all this together and see if I can track some trends and patterns that appear from these fae encounters.
So trans people seeing fae.
So, you know, actual data. Information,
right,
yeah. Dates, times, names, places.
Like real
people that exist, seeing things, interesting, real research on, you know, a very kind of fringe topic, and not about gnomes wearing KKK hoods or anything. Like, it's just, you know, real research.
You know what, though? If I came home one day into my house and I found three brownies sitting in my house wearing white hoods, I'd kick their faces off.
Well, that's why they have the pointy hats, you see. They just pull them down. They pull down their pointy hats.
I don't want white supremacist gnomes in my house. I get rid of them.
And this is really great encounters in here, and the way it's organized is really good too. Like, he includes the data from each case, like the eyewitness is female, it occurred in the 1950s, they were 0 to 10 years old with other people, the time it occurred between 12 p.m. and 3 p.m, where it occurred, and just general details from the survey, like there was a loss of the sense of time or a profound silence before the experience.
Yeah, so a lot of that Oz factor comes up a lot in those stories.
Strange, really vivid memories of the experience that are more vivid than usual memories. And this is how you start to see the patterns from, again, what seem like real cases. He says in the introduction, like, I can't say if these are real. But after a while, you start to see the patterns emerge and you can get a sense of whether something may be genuine or not.
Well, that's why I find with the stories that we do, this is where you can kind of gauge whether or not there is some truth to them. Because normally it's like, especially with stuff like this, you find people across time, across cultures that are reporting similar things that are disconnected from each other. You start seeing, there's something to it.
So one really simple example, and a lot of them are like this, there's one from England, 1950s, the eyewitness was female, said, my parents were taking all of us for a walk, there was five of us kids. I was running ahead and saw this fairy, an elf, she says. It stopped, and it took a moment before I could speak when I shouted for my mother to come and see. Everyone came, she said, but by the time they got to me, it had disappeared. Most people laughed at me, but my mother actually believed me because there was no reason not to. And she described what she saw. She says it was about 8 to 10 inches tall, a lovely face, dressed in greens, although she didn't see any wings. So there's actually hundreds, literally hundreds like this.
Yeah.
And I only got to the end of the England section, and I started going to some of the Irish accounts. Did you, when you looked at it, did you do any of the North American section?
I honestly can't recall, to tell you the truth. I think when I was doing it, I was looking into stories that kind of crossed over with the Threshold Guardians.
Okay.
I think that's what I was looking for, from what I can recall.
This is, I think, over 300 pages here.
Oh, yes. I remember it being really big.
We've hardly touched any of it. And there's so many great encounters. There's one from Birmingham that occurred in the 1990s. There's a female, 31 to 40. She was with several other people, but she was the only person to see this. She's basically sitting at a picnic table, minding the kids who are all playing. It was a nice sunny afternoon, and her mind was wandering a bit. She was just relaxing. And she looks up and she sees an elf lying along a branch in a large tree. Now, what surprised her was how tall it was. It was like a 6 foot tall elf, like a well-built man. But you could also tell it wasn't human. She said he was a dark color, and he was laughing at the kids. He was lolling around on a branch and almost seemed part of the tree. And she watched him for a bit, but as soon as her mind started to focus on what she was seeing, he simply disappeared.
Mm.
And again, her surprise was just, oh, I just thought these things were meant to be tiny, but this was a 6 foot tall. And she just had that feeling in her mind instantly that that's an elf. Not a, oh, under what I'm seeing there, is that a guy? It's almost like it was imprinted on her mind. That's an elf in the tree.
Yeah, I remember reading something about that only recently, actually, about this idea that the reason why, you know, fae folk may actually be a genuine phenomenon and not something that is part of folklore is because we seem to have, with a lot of the eyewitnesses, there's this inherent built-in, essentially like a psychological immune response to when people encounter them. And that's a perfect example of it. Mm. It's like the moment that people encounter these things, because they are dangerous. It's like when you see a snake today, you know it's a snake. You don't really even have to know. You just know it's a snake, and it's something you have to steer clear of. It's like this built from, you know, evolution and millennia of evolution. It's exactly the same with these things. It's like built in. You see, like, that's an elf.
So another one from Cambridgeshire in England, this time a male, 21 to 30. In the 2010s, he saw this in a private house. He and his partner had been watching television, and they'd switched the TV off and were talking for a bit. And he says he just glanced towards the area where the TV was and only fleetingly caught a glimpse of a small gnome-like man. He immediately looked again, but the entity had gone. And from that brief glimpse, though, he said it was like a classical cross between the description of a classical brownie or a classical gnome, 6 inches tall, scruffy, dark brown, black beard.
Little suit.
Covering its face, brightly coloured clothes, but he couldn't really remember exactly what they looked like. But one thing was they had been walking a few days earlier and they'd actually picked up some rocks outside, some interesting looking rocks, and they'd put those on the furniture, just kind of like on the edge of the arm of the chair. And he says that's where this little guy was sitting, on top of one of these rocks from outside.
So it's like the entity attached to one of those rocks.
So in the story, he says it's like the being, it wasn't malevolent, but maybe it was attracted to the rocks, but maybe it's the other way around.
Or
you're right.
Brought it in.
Maybe it was attached to the rocks. Maybe it was an entity in the rock, for example. There's a great story from Cornwall, this woman in the 1970s. She was about 13 when it happened. She was on holiday with her family and she was walking ahead on this, you know, little hike they were doing. And she came across this, well, she's a few steps ahead, she said, and she came across this gnome just sitting by the side of the path. It's kind of chilling out, just sitting there. She said it was so unexpected. I don't remember feeling scared or wondering if I was seeing things or going mad. But she said, I took another couple of steps and I saw his nut-browned, wizened face in detail. She said he was cheekily grinning at me. He had a mossy brown beard and dark brown shining eyes, and he was wearing a peaked hat and a shiny jacket and trousers in shades of brown and ochre. I'd say he was about 12 to 14 inches tall. I couldn't believe my eyes. I was too dumbstruck to turn around and tell my family to, you know, look at this gnome. And then she said he kind of cocked his head again. And again, it was this kind of cheeky, tricksterish grin it had. And she said it turned its back to her. And she uses the word transmogrified, it melted. It melted into an old tree stump, kind of became an old tree stump.
Mm.
And then her family kind of came past and she blurted out, "Mom, look it." And then she realized, I can't tell them. Like, what am I going to say? That I just saw a gnome?
Yeah.
And she didn't end up saying anything about it, but it's never left her, this idea that, well, she said afterwards, as she was walking along this walk with her family, she said it felt like a trick had been played on her and that this entity was getting a real kick out of her being bamboozled and not being able to tell anyone.
Yeah, they're very mischievous, these things.
And there's this great one from Cornwall, this woman and her husband in the year 2000, they're mid-20s, according to this report, and they're in this open field. They were hiking in this area that's known for these old standing stones that, you know, dating back to before the medieval era. And they're going on this hike and they're on the track heading towards this stone circle. When she said, we saw a man running down the hill. And she adds, when I say run, think about those dreams you have where you're taking leaps and the ground is rushing past you at 100 miles an hour. She said, that's how fast this guy was going. Like, you know, like an anime where someone's doing ninja running or something and the landscape is just flying past.
Got like Langoon or something.
This guy was going so fast, it was like a motor vehicle just flying down this hill. And they caught a glimpse of him and he immediately just goes, stops, like just skids to a stop. And she says her and her husband are just dumbfounded at what they're witnessing.
So they've both seen it.
Yeah, her and her husband both see this guy. And her husband waves. He's like, hey. And this guy turns, smiles at them, and waves back with this big grin. And then, phew, he just takes off at the same ridiculous speed. Now, she said he just kind of disappeared out of sight. He was the same sort of height and build as a really slim human. He had shoulder-length hair, which was the color of hematite, he said, a metallic dark gray.
Mm-hmm.
He wore olive green trousers and a long sleeve top, but she said the cut was really weird. It's not like clothes you would buy in a store. It looked really old fashioned or something you'd wear to a medieval fair. Like, it just looked ancient, his clothing. And she said, I felt a bit spooked by his appearance. And the whole time they were walking to the stone circle, they were talking about how strange the whole thing was, how they couldn't explain how fast this guy was going or who he was or where he was going. But when they entered the stone circle, everything started to change. Like, it was a beautiful sunny day and they enter this stone circle, this area, and this wind comes up and this strange fog envelops the area. It has a weird purple gray hue to it. And they spend a few minutes joking about, oh, we've entered some portal, but they're not taking it seriously. They're just joking about it. But when they stepped out of the circle and started hiking back down to their car, everything went back to normal again. Like, they really had... Yeah. Entered some other world. And as they were going back to their car, they were joking that, oh, we're going to find, you know, moss growing over it. And it's the year 2075 or something.
Mm.
No, they made it back to their car. But I just love the idea of this guy speeding down the mountain at 100 miles an hour, stopping and waving as if, you know, to give this kind of cheeky acknowledgement.
Well, the funny thing about these entities is that they seem to readily understand that we exist. But then we don't really acknowledge them very often. So maybe this is the first time or a rare time that we've acknowledged them.
But still, one of those patterns is they're surprised at being seen.
Yes.
You know, we see this, you know, in every second account. It's so, so common. But sometimes there's a purpose behind the encounters as well. There's one from Cornwall in the 1990s. It was a mid-20s guy. He was driving his car late at night on a country road. He was going about 45 miles per hour. And as he's driving along this road, something compelled him to look into the hedgerow on the other side. And he sees this brown, leathery-skinned, really angry-looking old man who's 2.5 feet high, completely naked, but he's got a little bit of leather where his bits are. He's got a loincloth on. And this guy's pointing at him, pointing at the driver. Now, the guy driving... time seemed to slow down. Like this what should have been an instant seemed to take forever. And he brakes sharply, slams on the brake, because he realizes that the road is falling sharply towards a seawall. And if he hadn't braked at the moment of seeing this weird old man, naked 2-foot-tall man with a loincloth, he would have actually gone over the edge of the sea cliff and smashed his car at the bottom.
Because kind of like a little guardian angel.
It was late at night. He didn't realize he was on that particular road. He actually thought he was somewhere else.
What a weird way, though, for your guardian angel to appear. Being a little half-naked gnome with a piece of leather around your waist.
He said he had an old-looking face with a hooked nose and large ears. He was bald and had very little hair and had really strange, large hands. And he added there was this weird silence in the surrounding air. The Oz effect was going on. Another case where there's this guy, again, in Cornwall in the 2010s. And again, these are all modern accounts. And he's driving his car late at night and he sees a little blue horse go past. Like he pulls
what
up.
What do you mean little? How tall are we talking?
He says it was about the size of a Labrador dog.
Oh.
And it's just, it's blue. It's like a blue horse, tiny blue horse. And its hair is all kind of glowing white and it had this odd glow about it. Now he says, as he pulls up, he's like, what the hell am I looking at? And he had a feeling that it was being followed by humanoids, by something else that he couldn't see. And he also had a feeling that whatever he couldn't see was kind of reading his mind, tickling his mind, sensing his intentions. And he saw the horse go past, but didn't see whatever else was following it. And that's, he just kept on driving. It's like, what the hell's going on? There's another case from Devon in the early 2000s where there's this woman calling her husband from home one night and she claims she saw a 2-meter-tall tree man cross the road in front of her house.
A tree man?
Yeah, she said it was just like an ent from Lord of the Rings, this giant tree entity. And she said the way it moved was so bizarre and purposeful, like it took nearly 2 minutes for it to cross the road because every step was an effort and it would have to swing its leg forward and boom, and then concentrate and swing its other leg forward. And it was just made of sticks and branches, but she could see a face on it. And she's totally normal. She's not drinking wine or anything.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, unfortunately, there's this kind of skeptical approach to when people tell these stories. Oh, you were drunk or you were hallucinating. But it just doesn't seem... There's so many people that aren't under the influence of anything that are psychologically stable that are seeing something.
And she was too scared to go out and do anything. But this
isn't, of course.
This isn't the only tree entity in this region that's been seen. There's 3 or 4 other reports of people saying, yeah, I saw this giant tree guy walking across the field.
Is it actually a tree though? Or is it just like a bunch of sticks together that's large and meandering around?
Well, she says it doesn't kind of finish in little twigs. From a distance, it looks like a tree, but it's clearly some kind of humanoid that's walking along. One of my favorites was from this guy in the 1980s in Essex, and he was out camping near the moors with a group of friends. And then one night one of the nights they were camping, he woke up at like 3 a.m. and he really had to piss really badly. And there were porta potties where they were camping, but that was so far. He thought, I'm just going to go and, you know, pee behind my tent. There was this hedgerow, maybe 10 meters from the back of his tent. So he just kind of walks over there in the dark, slowly unzips, you know, he's about to do his business. And he starts to notice there's this faint light coming from the hedge in front of him. And there's a hole in the hedge all of a sudden. And he gets the impression.
A fake glory hole.
He gets the impression that there's some anger coming towards him. And he hasn't started peeing yet.
Oh, but he's about to piss on their home.
And he looks down and there's this kind of silhouette. First of all, it's like a glowing silhouette, but then slowly there's this like 2.5 foot tall, like a child size man. And he's looking up at him, pointing his finger at him like, what the fuck are you doing, mate? What are you doing?
We're not in Manchester, okay. Actually, we might be.
And he has to be, like, you can imagine him, like, slowly putting his teeth back in his pants.
Step up, whoop, step zip, back.
Very slowly walking back. And he was so scared, he just held it all night and just went back to his tent. Now, when he got up in the morning, that hole in the hedge wasn't there. It was just one whole hedge. So it's like he had actually gone to piss on this...
on the doorway.
Gnome's doorstep, because this portal was gone in the morning.
Maybe that's why the doorway closed in New York. Maybe because there's people pissing in the streets all the time.
That's a great theory.
That's why it's closed. Yeah,
everyone peeing. There's another one that crosses over with UFO stuff. This great case from the 1950s near London. The guy was a kid in the report. He was about 5 or 6. And he says, look, this has haunted me forever. I swear this was not a dream. It happened in my back garden. My mother was hanging clothes on the washing line. And this sort of wicker basket type hot air balloon started to land in the backyard.
How big?
About the size of a beach ball. So the wicker basket was tiny, like this tiny little wicker basket, right? And he's looking at this, and it didn't quite land. It kind of hovered right near his head. And he's looking at his mother and looking at this
Please
floating
tell
balloon.
Me there's a little guy with a top hat.
Well, yeah, he's looking at his mother, and his mother's got her back turned, so she's not seeing anything. And he turns to this wicker basket, this strange floating contraption, and she says there was these small people inside. But there was an older man dressed in grey trousers. He remembers a grey top hat and a black jacket.
Perfect.
And this weird guy had silver hair, was curly and long, and he can't remember the conversation, but the gist of it was he had to go with them.
Oh.
He had to go with them.
It does have like an abductee feel about it.
In this little balloon thing.
How do you get in?
Now, he refused, of course, but he says... this little man was so persistent that I go with him. The memory of it has never left me. He said the whole contraption, when he disagreed, the whole contraption flew off. And he ran to his mother to tell her what had happened, but...
she wouldn't believe him.
She just thought he was, you know, making up a story.
Being a kid.
And he says, look, this happened. Everything, it wasn't a dream. Everything was real. It was all solid. The little man was speaking English to me. He says, I can't say this was a fairy experience, but the size of the being makes me feel it might be classed in this category. It was certainly no angel, he said. I felt it wanted to do mischief.
Mm.
This was not a friendly experience at all, he said. And he can't recollect reading anything as a child that would have, you know, informed a fantasy about that. He just can't understand where this came from. Lots of weird stories like this. When I finally got into the Irish section, which is about a third in, it seems to ramp up with the stories from Ireland. There was one where this witness saw something in the 1930s. It actually happened to their father's sister, their aunt. She was very close to this local vicar who had died suddenly sometime in the 1930s. And after the death, but before the burial, she was sitting in this deck chair in the sun near her house, and she started to hear all these small voices nearby. And she thought maybe someone's turned on the radio or, you know, something's on. But finally she looks around and she sees coming through the garden towards her, the vicar who's just passed away. And he's being dragged along the ground. Now he looks pale and stricken like he's dead, but he's surrounded and being pulled by all these little fairy people. They're like the size of small children. They're dragging him along the ground.
Is he actually, you know, alive, or does it look like it's his dead double or something?
He's struggling. He's distraught. She's freaked out because, first of all, the vicar's dead.
Mm.
And who are these weird little creatures? So she runs inside the house. She tries to get help. And no one believed her, basically. They went outside. They couldn't see anything. But this is funny because this idea, this is kind of cognizant with how dangerous it is for people in transitional states to be taken by the fae folk.
Mm.
See, it's not only, you know, when you're alive, it's when you're dead, apparently. Before you've kind of gone on to wherever you go to or fully completed that transition, you're in that liminal state. You're in that in-between. Yeah, maybe he didn't realize, maybe his death wasn't what he expected, or maybe he didn't realize he was dead. That apparently is an opportunity for them to get to you. Now, there's a similar story like this earlier on where this guy writes in and he said, look, when my mother was dying of cancer, he said, I couldn't feed her. And he explained that he would come in the morning and he would try and, you know, give her porridge or whatever she was meant to eat. And she would say, oh no, I'm full. And he would say, how can you be full? You haven't eaten anything. And she would say, oh, the little boy with golden hair came and gave me a pie just a few minutes ago. And every time he would try and feed her, like he could feed her a little bit, but often she wouldn't want to touch any food because always she'd talk about this little boy with golden hair who had either given her some nice pie or, you know, some kind of delicious soup or some amazing food. And she said, oh, no, I'm quite full. I couldn't eat another bite. And he was aware of fairy folklore. And because she was basically on her deathbed, she had very, you know, terminal cancer, he could see this parallel between the stories and her eating the fairy food.
Yeah, and basically setting herself up to go with the fae folk.
And it's like as her illness progressed, it got to the point where, yeah, she was starting to change. And he says he's seen people die of cancer before and gotten close to death, but the way she was changing was different. Her eyes were changing, he said, and no longer was he seeing, you know, his mother dying of cancer. He was now seeing something else slowly taking over his mother.
Oh.
It was like this weird changeling at the point of death because she was in this liminal state where she was ready to change over. She was ready to transfer over. She was vulnerable.
But was it possessing her or draining her of her spirit or her life energy?
We don't know. I mean, when she passed away, he said by the end, you know, she was seeing all sorts of things. Like she was seeing strange dead animals in the room and other strange entities coming into the room.
You have to wonder, though, if drugs play a role in that because obviously end stage cancer.
She wasn't on anything.
At all.
Apparently, all she had was Tylenol, like just very general painkillers. It wasn't until later when she actually went into the hospice or wherever.
Yeah, because it's really painful, apparently. So they put you on heavy doses of painkillers. So I can understand the hallucinations then.
This was all before that. Mm. So I won't mention the rest of the tree man encounters because they're all white supremacists. but I'll link to this report in the show notes. There's a full PDF you can download if you want to read about the evil racist tree men.
Oh, it's just ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
That is from the Fairy Census website, fairiest.com. And there's some great stuff also from Neil Rushton I was looking into today, which I didn't get a chance to, you know, fully pack into the show. But the whole thing was, you know, I was so in shock at how stupid the Finding Fairies book by Alexandra Rowland was that I just wanted to find people that actually do good research and take the topic seriously and don't just fill it with nonsense to be there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even the concept of, I was thinking about it, you know, the concept of your phone having an entity, it doesn't really fit in with traditional fae folk stories anyway, though. Like the idea that you've got...
No, I've got no problem with that idea. If you want to talk about that idea, that's fine. But give me an example.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Give me the actual concept behind it, how it would work. Give me examples from history that might relate to a modern version of that. You can't just tell me to de-fairy my iPhone and install some Chrome add-on that doesn't exist.
But you know what? How fairiest is that?
It's very fairy.
How pharophobic is that?
Yeah.
Like, so what if your phone's got a fairy in it?
That is fairy folk.
It has a right to be able to... It's actually possessing your land. It was there before you, and now you think you've got a right to expel it? How dare you?
Good point, Aaron.
How dare you?
It's the symbols. It's the symbols.
The symbols.
That's a wrap for this Plus Show. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next MU. Until then, have a great week.